I'm Craig McClure, Executive Director of the International AIDS Society. We had a very exciting, thrilling plenary this session this morning on HIV prevention. With us today are our three plenary presenters, Myron Cohen, the J. Herbert Bate Distinguished Professor of Medicine, Microbiology, Immunology, and Public Health at the University of North Carolina, and Director of the UNC Division of Infectious Disease and the UNC Institute for Global Health and Infectious Disease. Adiba Kamaruzzaman, the Head Professor of Infectious Diseases at the University of Malaya in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, where she manages the HIV/AIDS Tertiary Referral and Research Center. And Jorge Saavedra, Head of the National HIV/AIDS Program in Mexico, referred to as SENSIDA, responsible for launching the universal access to ARV policy in Mexico, who delivered today's Jonathan Mann Memorial Lecture on Sex Between Men. I'm going to ask each of the three speakers to briefly review, provide a summary of their plenary presentation this morning, then I'll open it up for questions. And I'd like to start with you, Mike, Myron.
I spoke about four different opportunities for prevention. The first opportunity arises for people who are HIV, not infected with HIV. There are a variety of behavioral and structural strategies that we know make a huge difference. The second opportunity is at the moment of exposure, where we're trying to find biological tools that can prevent a transmission event. We study the transmission event in great detail in order to develop those tools. The ideas there are develop a vaccine, which is a long-range goal, and more exciting perhaps for right at this moment is the use of antiviral therapy as pre-exposure prophylaxis. Many trials are ongoing to accomplish that goal, both topically and systemically. After exposure, there's a small window of time for prevention using antivirals. And then the last opportunity, the fourth opportunity, is to help people to identify their status, bring more people into treatment, and demonstrate that the treated person is no longer contagious or much less contagious. Work in all of those areas ongoing. I tried to summarize that activity.
Thank you. I'd like to turn now to Adiba Kamaruzzaman.
My topic was on substance use and harm reduction, and essentially I outlined that outside of sub-Saharan Africa, 30% of HIV infection globally is due to injecting drug use, and certainly in the region that I work in, Asia and Central and Eastern Europe, injecting drug use is the main driver of the HIV epidemic. The evidence for the effectiveness of harm reduction, i.e. Opiate substitution therapy, needle exchange programs, outreach, education information, has long been established, but there's been reluctance by many governments to implement these harm reduction measures, resulting in many million infections around the globe. And this is largely due to a conflict in global policies with regards to drug use, with much more emphasis on law enforcement and criminalization of drug users as opposed to the health aspects of it. And I outlined the not just the poor access to prevention for drug users, but also poor access to antiretroviral therapy for injecting drug users as compared to others who become HIV infected.
Thank you. Before I turn to Jorge Saavedra, I'd just like to say on behalf of the IS and all of the conference organizers that we'd like to congratulate the Mexican government for showing leadership in providing methadone for all delegates who require it at this conference. Methadone and buprenorphine continue to remain illegal in Mexico, and we hope that this is the first step towards implementing comprehensive substitution therapy in Mexico. Turn now to you, Jorge.
So my presentation was on the topic of sex between men in the context of HIV. And the main discussion here was that knowing what the epidemiology is showing us, that the prevalence rates among some subpopulations, MSM is the highest one in several countries of the world. And if countries try to find it, they will find it in terms of high prevalence rates. Even in countries where there is no information about MSM, HIV infection rates. And even knowing that the highest prevalence rates are among this subpopulation, it shows in terms of funds that is not a priority. That is not a priority, and people are, or governments, some governments are denying this reality. Just a few countries of the world are addressing this issue openly, and we think that a lot of the barriers to access, not just health services, but also for testing and for other kind of services, is stigma, discrimination, and homophobia. And that's why we were linking epidemiology, financing, and human rights. So the central message was that if you don't follow the epidemiology of HIV, if you don't follow the facts, if you don't follow scientific evidence, then I think and we really think that we have the truth with us, is that we are going to lose the fight against HIV if we don't focus on or if we don't prioritize where the most needed are located.
Thank you very much. I think that today's plenary, these three speakers showed so clearly how if we can combine all of the evidence combine all of the biomedical prevention interventions we have with treatment, with comprehensive harm reduction interventions, and legal and policy protections for people's human rights who are vulnerable to HIV, then we really can have a dramatic impact on reducing new infections and keeping people alive, marrying treatment and prevention, as Dr. Cohen said. I'd like to open up for questions now. If you'd please state your name and media house before you ask your question. Microphone.
Andre Picard, the Globe and Mail in Canada. My question is for Dr. Kemmer Rulzaman. There's one harm reduction measure you didn't talk about specifically that I'd like you to comment on, and that's safe injection sites like we have in Canada, which are an area of some controversy now. Could you comment on them and their benefits? Thank you.
Sure, of course. I think the benefits of safe injection sites have been shown, but again, many governments are disinclined to implement this program because it's often seen as legalizing heroin and other drugs for the country. Yeah.
Thank you. Regina Olson from Excelsior Newspaper, Mexico. It's a question for Mr. Myron Cohen. I would like to know specifically how does the system of post-exposure prophylaxis works, and which hospitals have developed this strategy in the more advanced way. Thank you.
Okay. So the first issue is about post-exposure prophylaxis. We can only do animal experiments. For a variety of reasons, we can't really do human experiments. But the animal experiments suggest that if you offer the animal who's been exposed by either a needle stick or a sexual route, a mucosal route, that the animal that receives drugs within 3 days, but better is sooner, if they get drugs within 3 days and they take the drugs for 28 days, that the risk is drastically reduced of a seroconversion event. Now, for healthcare workers, every hospital in the world is not just a system of hospitals. Every medical facility where needles are used is really bound to have available these drugs for emergent use in the case of a needle stick exposure. So it's not optional. And there are guidelines available from the US CDC, and then there are every country has generated guidelines for this purpose. The sexual exposure is a little bit more complicated. Then you go to an emergency room, you convey your risk. And in the emergency room, healthcare workers are to know, have you described a risk that is reasonable? A risk that suggests you might acquire HIV. If you suggest that such a risk has occurred, then you should be treated the same way as a healthcare worker. Emergent use of agents to prevent infection for 28 days.
Is there a chance that the post-exposure prophylaxis could be used in humans? Is there a way to how say, prove them on humans?
No.
No.
Because I'll tell you the reason why really quickly. Because we don't often know whether a person was actually... In the needle stick case, we do know if there's been an exposure, but the transmission events are too rare. The transmission event is only 1 in 300. So in order to do a trial, you would need thousands and thousands of exposures. It would never take place. We've tried to model such a trial. You need 60,000 or 80,000 volunteers. It's just not possible. So we only do animal experiments, and we make guidelines.
Just a corollary question to stay on the same topic. From the floor, you mentioned that in monkey trials, two monkeys taking two pills of Truvada are, quote, protected, according to the question, for 22 hours. I think there's some confusion
okay.
about that.
Yeah, this is very obviously in the talk itself. I'm talking about a lot of things. She asked a question about after exposure, but the monkey trial that the journalist is asking about is before exposure. So now you're talking about offering a pill like a morning before pill. Now, the way the trials have been done in monkeys and the way the trials are being done in human, it's not really a morning before pill because the pills are being given every day for a year or some long period of time. That's okay, but it's not true pre-exposure prophylaxis. The study I was showing you, which is unpublished but is work being done by the investigators at the US CDC, they're trying to reduce the number of pills. And they're saying, and I'll be very specific, they're saying in their limited experiments that if they give pills before... And in the case of the limited experiments, I want to be cautious about this, if they give pills 72 hours before or 22 hours before, and then after exposure, 2 hours after exposure, they saw a benefit. Not a perfect benefit, but a benefit. And what they're trying to do is move away from daily pills to a limited number of pills. Now, this will take years to develop the whole strategy. And all the ongoing clinical trials are with daily therapy. The microbicide field, of course, is a little bit different. So I think that's sufficient.
And if I can just ask further questions on this issue of the use of antiretrovirals to prevent HIV infection, there will be a press conference at 12 o'clock after this press conference specifically on this issue. There's a lot of talk from different angles, the use of antiretrovirals for prevention in one way or another. So if we can hold further questions about that until 12.
I want to clarify one thing, Greg, and let me be absolutely clear. I showed you unpublished data volunteered by investigators doing the work. They're not done. This is work in progress. But it's work that leads us to believe this is a field that can be developed. So let me be very cautious about this. It's not completed. It's in progress. But it directs us. Is that clear, Greg?
That's very clear. Come back at 12 o'clock for an in-depth discussion about those issues. Take the question from the front, please. Microphone? Okay, go ahead.
I'm Sumita Thapar from India, representing DPA. My question is for Mr. Salvador. What lessons can the world learn from Mexico's response among MSM and...
Well, I honestly think that the first one is to talk openly about the issue. To say it, to mention, and to do research, do prevalence studies, do work on it. But I really think that the first step is to say it, to openly say it. If people still denying this reality, it is very difficult to work with MSM population. So. Sometimes it is needed that high position government officials or politicians to address these issues openly. It's not a population to blame because of age of HIV or guilty ones, nothing like that. It is that because this is a subpopulation that is suffering more the effects of HIV, so then they need to be in a priority of the HIV response. So I really think that the first lesson is to say it openly, to talk openly about these issues. That will be the first step, definitely.
Thank you. Richard Ingham from the French news agency, AFP. I would like to ask a question which is a question which would be asked, I think, by the general public, and I'd like to ask each of you to answer briefly. a lot of these, in fact, most of these prevention strategies have been known for years, if not decades, and yet we've still got 33 million people who are infected with HIV, and the toll, we have 7,000 people each day who are becoming infected. Why have these strategies failed, or why are they not being implemented?
Should we start with Adiba?
Well, I think with drug users, and it's pretty much the same, if I may say, with MSM as well, it's a stigma, it's a criminalization, it's the legal policies that inhibit the implementation of these programs. Even in countries where the harm reduction has been adopted, for instance mine, it's still being done under a cloud of suspicion and lots of legal barriers, making scale-up, you know, to the 60% or 80% of the population that needs his services extremely difficult still, because you have police raids, you have, ongoing stigma and discrimination.
I would kind of take issue, to be argumentative, I'll take issue with the idea that we've had the tools for years. The first antiviral drug was developed in 1988-1990. We had one antiviral drug. We've come to 22 drugs now. The first even belief we could use the drugs worldwide was the chaos of 2000 to 2004. So I think it's pretty spectacular that in 2008 we're doing trials using now the combinations of agents that were developed out of the clear blue sky. They didn't exist 20 years ago. You know, think of how long it took us to make penicillin, and even think about prophylaxis with penicillin. We're into an era that takes time to get into, but it's an exciting era, and I think it's realizing its potential at a very rapid pace, not a slow pace.
In my case, I will say that this because of denial, and also because some things that are being here as tools to be used in the fight against HIV. I remember when some groups here in Mexico were telling us that condoms are failing, condom promotion policies are failing, because we're still growing on the epidemic. But my answer was, okay, all the HIV, new cases of HIV in Mexico that are sexually transmitted are because not using condoms. So it's not that condoms policy is failing. The thing is that probably we haven't reached everyone in order to convince them to use condoms. So in the case of sex between men, the first problem is denying and not getting involved openly in supporting HIV intervention directed specifically for these groups.
If I can just finalize by saying what we're seeing differently at this conference is a political leadership from international leaders influencing national governments to implement legal and policy changes that are barriers to prevention and treatment for the most vulnerable communities, implementing sex and drugs education for young people, prepubescent young people 8 to 12, and scaling up and mobilizing resources to scale up health interventions in the health sector. Larry, you were next.
Yes, Dr. Cohen, in your plenary session, I believe you said there were 33 trials, randomized controlled trials on prevention, that only four showed benefit, three for male circumcision and one for an STD. Aren't there trials showing the benefit of needle exchange and other means of prevention?
I was focused entirely in my talk on sexual transmission of HIV. So I was only alluding to trials that had been done. And that's a paper by Judy Wasserheit. That slide comes from her manuscript. So not dealing with MTCT, many, many trials, of course, dozens of trials, really important trials. My talk only on sexual transmission, really only heterosexual transmission. 25 minutes, that's it.
Okay, then the question for the panelists, since we're talking about prevention overall, how many trials have there been overall and how many have been effective?
I think in terms of injecting drug use, I don't know, there may be others in the room who could quote the number of trials, but there have been many, many reviews, including the one that I mentioned by the Institute of Medicine. There have been many Cochrane reviews on the effectiveness of both opiate substitution therapy and needle exchange, and I think the arguments, the scientific arguments for at least for harm reduction is pretty solid.
And likewise, Larry, there are many reviews every month just about. There's another completed trial of the best way to prevent maternal-to-child transmission, the most recently being the PEPI study. So there's many, many, you know, other trials of prevention, fields outside heterosexual prevention. Microphone.
That should be,
we can hear you, Larry.
That's the type of information that should be submitted at conferences like that. This is to provide that information. Many, many means many, anything to the beholder. Where is the information being presented? We're short on data here.
I think the message back to you, Larry, is that there is vast amounts of scientific evidence for harm reduction, for other prevention interventions, and that the issue is the political will to scale up the delivery of the interventions for which there is vast scientific proof. Now, we're not talking about new interventions that Myron was talking about today, PrEP, the use of antiretrovirals in chronically infected patients for prevention. We don't have ample studies for that yet.
It's also sexual. It's only sexual.
Can we go now to Andrea Downer, please?
Thank you. Good morning. I'm from the Caribbean, Jamaica, and our Bogle Law dates back to the 1800s. What is the significance of the Panama's recent move to change by executive order their Bogle Law? And would you, in terms of what advice would you give all players, that is media, government, civil society, and MSMs, in terms of how they would engage to achieve similar results elsewhere where there's a stubborn resistance to repealing these laws that impact on prevention and other intervention methods with MSMs? That's just one question. I have two more.
So, we know that in the case of the Caribbean, there are many countries that have these kinds of laws. The information that I provided is that it was just the only Latin country that had that kind of laws, and they changed it, even if knowing that it was a very old law, but it was there. They told me, well, we are not using that law. Yeah, well, if you are not using that law, why is it still there? So that's the point. I mean, if you don't want to send a message that the government or the institutions are not homophobic, why do we keep those laws into place? And of course, it helps a lot to be highlighted into the international arena. That's something that really helps local people to deal, not to deal with, at least to approach the government people in order to withdraw those kinds of laws. Some of them might be coming from religious beliefs, and sometimes that is harder. But sometimes some of them are just there because they have been always there, and nobody have taken care of analyzing the implications of those laws, if they are really into effect or not. But the point is, yes, we need to have those laws away. Decriminalization is needed. Some countries do apply those laws, so I really don't have a recipe to tell someone how to withdraw those laws, except for human rights declarations, human rights concerns, and I think the human rights approach can help a lot to the people living there and suffering because of these laws. And of course, the other thing is HIV/AIDS is a health crisis for MSMs.
All right, thank you very much. My second question, I'll
move
quickly.
This will be your last question. You don't get three.
Okay, good.
You shouldn't even get two, but we'll give you two.
In your role as board member of the Global Fund representing Latin America and the Caribbean, you mentioned in the plenary, not in your role, but you had mentioned in the plenary that there's a stark lack of inclusion of programs geared towards MSMs in the submissions. To what extent Did you see the lack of MSM-specific programs in submissions to the Global Fund from Latin America and the Caribbean? In particular, the recent submissions, which will be considered shortly to be granted this November. Thank you.
Yes, I think they are really needed. I mean, they should be submitted and resubmitted. I mean, in Latin America and the Caribbean, that's the top priority. If countries don't do it, well, probably they are doing it, one, on purpose, on the other one, because of ignorance. But the data is there. The other approach is to find the data. I mean, if you do these prevalence studies, you'll find a lot of information that can help you to do a strong proposal where the need is in terms of financing the response.
Thanks. Next question, please. I thought it was you, but Martin, if you're not prepared, Martin.
Okay, Martin Flynn from IAS. My question is to Dr. Cohen. It's about the marriage that he proposed this morning between treatment and prevention. And you said we have to use every tool in the box right now, right away, to stop HIV. And you talked about how prevention is lagging behind treatments. But my question is about this marriage. Are this couple willing to even get engaged?
Yeah.
And who is going to pay for the wedding?
Right,
is it going to be the pharmacos, or will governments be prepared to pay for it?
Thank you for staying with the metaphor. I really appreciate it. Let's stay with it.
Who's going to pay for the wedding?
There was a book that many of you have seen that I think is a really important book called HIV Prevention in the United States, No Time to Waste, an Institute of Medicine report in about 2000. I was part of that preparation of a book on behalf of the U.S. CDC. And in that book, we had a whole chapter devoted to the same issue, exactly what you've just asked. We are willing to train healthcare providers. We have three different groups that are involved in this. We have the prevention health, the public health prevention experts. We have the community, who are very concerned about prevention in their communities. And we've got the treatment providers, the healthcare providers, whether they're physicians or other healthcare workers. Most of our energy for the healthcare workers goes into their expertise at the use of the drugs, and that's appropriate. These are hard drugs to use. There's a lot of biology and management. But we've been unable to fully engage the treatment community in the prevention activities. Now, attempts are being made, and then in the IOM report, a whole chapter, it's no time to waste. We said, let's do this now, and let's pay the healthcare workers to get them involved in this. But to my knowledge, for the most part, that hasn't occurred. Now, let me indicate that the U.S. government and other governments have more and more tried to get the clinics that provide care to get into this, for the physicians or other healthcare workers to have the time to do this. But their time is very constrained. It is time-consuming to ask about sexual history, about your partner. Please bring in your partner. These are the challenges. So I'm not going to give you the answer you want, who's going to pay for it. I'm going to say that it's clear we need to do this because we're going to treat more and more people in the United States and other countries. And we're proud of that treatment effort, but we can't treat our way out of the epidemic, a quote that's been used over and over and over again. Now, we implore the U.S. government's PEPFAR program to do more and more prevention along with its treatment efforts. And that's an evolving process.
Next question.
Ruth Pollard from the Sydney Morning Herald in Australia. My question is to Jorge and also to Craig, if you want to weigh in on this. We've known that these epidemics amongst men who have sex with men communities throughout the world have been happening. This is no surprise for us. They didn't happen overnight. Why have our international agencies been so slow to respond and intervene with prevention and treatment programs for these people?
Well, if it is okay with you, I would like to ask one of my co-authors of this plenary to try to give a response on that.
And that would be Chris or...
Good afternoon. I'm Jose Zasola. I work for UNAIDS. I'm co-author of Dr. Jorge Saavedra. I believe one of the reasons is that some of the responses to the HIV epidemic are demand-driven by the countries. And if, as Dr. Saavedra has shown, the data is not there, or when it's there, people don't act upon that. That's one of the reasons that there is no demand for support. I believe what Corby was suggesting about the Global Fund proposals, that they don't include strategic information and action upon that, that's one of the main reasons. And I believe, essentially, UNAIDS is promoting know and act, know your epidemic and act on, upon that. I believe that's a response to this situation.
What I can add to that is, first of all, international agencies don't provide services. Services are provided within countries, either through the public sector, NGOs, faith-based organizations, or in the workplace. What international agencies can do is provide leadership to governments of the world to make policy changes to protect the human rights of the people that live within those countries. It's very difficult to provide services to men who have sex with men in countries that don't acknowledge they exist or criminalize them if they do exist. So I think the leadership you're calling for, which we're just beginning to see now, is leadership from the United Nations to make bold statements to their member states that the criminalization of homosexuality is against basic principles of human rights. Next question. Chris. Oh, you want to add to the previous question? Go ahead. Chris Beyer from Johns Hopkins.
Hi, thanks for that question. I guess I would just add that it's certainly true that MSM, gay men, have been a part of the HIV epidemic, unfortunately, from the very beginning. But another element that really is changing is that we are seeing emerging epidemics in places where we really have not ever looked, studied, done the surveillance data, where MSM have not been included, particularly in national surveillance programs. So we don't really know at this point whether these are newly emerging epidemics or that we've never really looked before. But the data, particularly from Africa, from sub-Saharan Africa, from Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, from areas in Asia, South Asia and Southeast Asia, these data are really emerging just now. And I would refer you all as well to the recent AMFAR report on the state of the epidemic, global epidemic in MSM, which captures some of the epidemiology in detail about these emerging developing country MSM epidemics. And this, of course, was a major part of Dr. Saavedra's plenary this morning, was to try and bring some of that new data forward and the evidence that, that these really are hidden epidemics among underserved men. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Next question. At the back, standing up. Sorry, I can't see that far.
IFARATV.org in Oregon. I wanted to ask the question of why is it that we don't have an international document from scientists from around the world demanding that the research that they have produced is really the way to go, and that catalog attached to that document of all that research that could then be kind of the roadmap to the successes that we've had in the research.
I guess this builds on Larry's previous
question. Yes, exactly.
Comments on that very wise recommendation? A call for a compendium of all evidence and various interventions and prevention.
Put it all on the table, put it in a very large document, make it a profound statement of the science of this world, and just be done with it. I mean, at this point, we're kind of piecemealing here and there, and there's so much on access, treatment, prevention, all these subjects that are profoundly produced evidence, and to not adhere to that and understand it and listen to it is just beyond probably all of us in this room.
I mean, of course, all that information in the age of the digital age is available,
right? Let me say one thing. I think, to avoid confusion, that there are different epidemics based on the route of transmission. We're not dealing with one biological set of events. I would say that without doubt, and I don't have the evidence, I don't work, Chris may know the answer. I think there's no doubt that if you provide clean needles, that the number of people who acquire HIV by IDUs is drastically reduced. Now, Larry wants the exact number of trials done. I think that's reasonable. Chris may know that. Do you know off the top of your head? I mean, I think, let me just say one little turn to Chris. The other point is the mother-to-child transmission field. That, again, is a very rapidly evolving field. It's in progress. We know the benefit, we see tremendous benefit from the mom taking antivirals. We then now know that if the baby is given post-exposure prophylaxis, this is in the first really true proof of human post-exposure prophylaxis, if the baby gets at those pills, a post-exposure prophylaxis for several months, that baby is also protected beyond the childbirth experience. That's a different field, but a field that's moving very fast. And it's very reasonable for you to say what's going on in that field. That's a different part of this meeting. Now, and I think the evidence exists for that. So those are two fields. But that leaves us then with the third field, which is the biggest field, the sexual transmission of HIV, in which there are heterosexual and homosexual transmission events. Again, and so we can't make one compendium. I do think Chris can tell you how many trials have been done about needle sticks. The people who work in the mom-to-baby prevention can tell you exactly how many trials have been done. They have a very strong direction, and that's working beautifully. We will succeed at mom-to-baby stuff, and we can succeed at the IDU stuff, given the tools at civil society. So, Chris.
Let me turn to Adiba first, and then we'll turn to you, Chris.
As I showed in my presentation, WHO has produced these leaflets of evidence for action, which actually speaks to, you know, the trials that have been done in the various components of harm reduction, needle exchange, harm reduction in prisons, opiate substitution therapy. So these information is available. The extensive review done by the Institute of Medicine went through almost every trial that was have been conducted in the field of harm reduction. It exists in a book, in a very nice book also that was shown in the plenary. So this information is out there, I think.
Thank you. Do you want to add?
I can't tell you exactly how many needle exchange trials.
Thank you. Do you want to add to that, Chris?
Well, just to say, I think the in terms of randomized controlled trials, the largest number of trials have been done in substitution therapy. And those, of course, began with methadone. We had the first methadone trials as an HIV prevention effort. Methadone was already validated as a drug treatment in the early 1990s, David Metzger's work. There is now a trial underway, which is the first randomized controlled trial, looking at Suboxone, that is the combination buprenorphine-naltrexone, as HIV prevention. It already is validated in a number of randomized controlled trials as substitution therapy for drug treatment, but as HIV prevention. That's an HPTN trial. In the arena of needle and syringe exchange as such, we don't have so many randomized controlled trials because this is one of those interventions that's almost impossible to study in a blinded fashion. You can't deny people clean needles and syringes. You certainly can't expect people to use dirty ones. So therefore, what we have mostly are large ecological, observational, epidemiologic studies. And this is somewhat relates to what Dr. Cohen was saying about the post-exposure prophylaxis. There are certain kinds of interventions that just don't suit themselves to the randomized trial. Nevertheless, the most important ecological study was the 56 or 58 city study that was done, an analysis of a number of cities with and without needle and syringe exchange following prospectively IDU populations, and that was published by Caldor et al. In The Lancet. And that is often the one that is referred to as sort of the strongest evidence base for needle and syringe exchange. But there are no direct, that I know of, randomized controlled blinded trials of needle and syringe exchange as such.
Thank you. Se puede también preguntar en español si quieren ustedes. ¿Una pregunta en español?
Hola, buenos días. Margarita Vega del periódico Reforma de México. Al doctor Saavedra le quería preguntar si nos podía ayudar a conocer las tasas de la prevalencia entre usuarios de drogas inyectables en México, prevalencia de VIH, obviamente, y qué es lo que ha detenido una terapia de este tipo, porque en México no se aplica de forma masiva, es cuestión de financiamiento, es cuestión de prejuicios, ¿a qué se debe? Y, perdón, ¿hasta qué punto, eso sería todos los expositores también, esta política tan fuerte de lucha contra las drogas y el crimen organizado, que se entiende que está justificada, no puede empezar a interferir contra un proyecto de este tipo? Gracias.
Did the English speakers all understand the question related to application of harm reduction in Mexico, given the war on drugs that's continuing? That's a big problem. In Mexico. Do you want to start, Jorge?
Bien. Bueno,
en español también.
En el caso de México, estrategias de reducción del daño para usuarias de drogas inyectadas, de hecho, las hemos financiado desde el Programa Nacional y se han hecho a través de organizaciones de la sociedad civil o algunas instituciones académicas. El problema en México con uso de drogas inyectadas, como aquí en México sabemos, y tal vez no lo sepan desde otros países, está concentrado sobre todo en la frontera norte, en las ciudades que están fronterizas con Estados Unidos. No es que México no tenga problema de drogas, se usan mucho, pero son de otro tipo, sobre todo las inhaladas. Las inyectadas son un poco más caras. Sin embargo, este fenómeno sí se presenta como una cuestión transcultural en la zona fronteriza con Estados Unidos. Ahí sí hemos hecho, financiado proyectos, y sobre el conflicto con los programas que tienen que ver con cuestiones de reducción del uso de drogas, efectivamente es muy difícil, ha sido muy difícil trabajar con ellos. Sin embargo, el año antepasado ya sacamos un documento de posición conjunta entre el Consejo Nacional contra las Adicciones y el CENCIDA para hacer acciones conjuntas. Al menos ya existe un documento de posición al respecto en materia de intercambio de jeringas y limpieza de agujas.
Would someone else like to comment from the panel? No? Okay. Here. And just to let everyone know, you are aware there are headphones.
Soy Chi López Barrón del Núcleo Radio 1000. Yo quisiera, doctor Saavedra, si me precisara que en el caso de México, ¿cuál es el camino a seguir? Digo, primero, si nos precisara, ¿estos hombres que tienen sexo con hombres son los que están teniendo también sexo con mujeres y que lo están llevando hacia este sector, o solamente se está quedando hacia los hombres? Porque ahí ya, ahora sí que se confundió la situación, hacia dónde está caminando propiamente la epidemia. Y si se tendrían que hacer en nuestro país algún tipo de modificaciones legales precisamente para ir combatiendo esta discriminación y la homofobia. Y también quisiera, doctor, ¿qué llamado haría a estos hombres o a la sociedad? Porque a fin de cuentas son ellos los que estén manteniéndose ocultos y los que están infectando, por lo que entiendo. Si me lo precisa, gracias.
Bueno, en la presentación hicimos la definición de lo que es hombres que tienen sexo con hombres. Esto no quiere decir que también tengan sexo con mujeres. Algunos lo tienen con mujeres y con hombres, y otros lo tienen solo con hombres. Entonces, en esa clasificación iban incluidos todos. El énfasis que hemos dado en materia de las prevalencias que se tienen, no solo en México, sino en todo el mundo, que son más altas en el sector de hombres que tienen sexo con hombres, no estábamos diciendo que eran exclusivas ni únicas. Sí son desproporcionadamente más altas. No podemos decir que haya un sector de la población al que se le tenga que culpar, que ellos son los responsables de transmitir el virus. Evidentemente, la transmisión del virus es por sexo sin protección. En este sentido, tendría menos oportunidades de trabajo, menos oportunidades de crecer dentro de las empresas o de las compañías o de las posiciones donde están. Por lo tanto, mientras no se impulsen leyes de igualdad que den los mismos derechos y la misma protección, y aparte se hagan campañas para la sensibilización social, va a ser muy difícil que la gente primero salga del closet en el sentido de tener una orientación sexual diferente sin sentir que va a tener eso consecuencias, por lo que yo no podría decir que hay que culpar o responsabilizar a alguien. Yo lo que sí creo es que es necesario seguir insistiendo en el uso del condón como una medida de protección en todas las relaciones sexuales donde hay penetración. ¿Qué cambios legales se requieren en México? Efectivamente, modificar algunas leyes y a lo mejor crear una ley nacional de igualdad, donde a partir de esa todas las otras se modifiquen, incluyendo no solo uniones civiles, sino igualdad, como se tiene, por ejemplo, en España, ¿no?, donde el matrimonio está permitido entre personas que simplemente manifiestan quererse y querer vivir juntas.
Thank you. Perhaps you could talk after the session because we need to stop now. I'd like to thank the presenters, thank all of you.